All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. It keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Quay.
Why eat beef snack seal?
Tan she.
Tanet e. Negad dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Quay, Nindeluizi Pam Palmeter. Hi, I'm Pam Palmeter, and I'm your host for the Mi'kmaq episodes of Words and Culture. I'm a member of Ugbaganjig, otherwise known as Eel River Bar First Nation, and that's part of the larger Mi'kmaq nation on the sovereign territory we refer to as Mi'kma'ki. It's the place that I was born, and it connects me to all my ancestors. Today's guest is one of my favorite people, Cheryl Maloney. I've always followed her work, and after this episode, I think you'll understand why. Cheryl is a powerful advocate for social justice, human rights, and protecting endangered species in the environment. She's the former president of the Nova Scotia Aboriginal Women's Association, where she helped raise the alarm on the crisis of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls to hold Canada to account so we can help bring the violence to an end. She's also been an instructor who teaches everything there is to know about Indigenous issues and Mi'kmaq studies. But I know her best as a Mi'kmaq rights activist who's taken whatever action is necessary to live, assert, and defend all of our Mi'kmaq rights, including our treaty rights. Quay, hello, Cheryl. Quay. Oh, sorry, I'll start that again. I'm still practicing the language. Quay, hello, Cheryl. Upchalasi, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Walal and Pam. Very excited, happy to be here. And I didn't know who you were talking about, but I'm like, it's a pretty deadly introduction. I had to use a shibby slang of deadly. Each community and each res have their sayings, and a lot of them are in the strong Mi'kmaq speaking communities. They have their slang, and they have words that mean nothing to anybody else in the world to them, except for them. So, you know, I'm glad to be here, and thank you.
One of the reasons why I really wanted to have you on this show is because I've followed your work for decades. As you know, it's hard to believe it's been decades. And I try to make sure that as a Mi'kmaq woman, I'm living up to the high bar that you've set for how we're supposed to relate to our territory, to our districts and our extended families in Mi'kma'ki, which is Mi'kmaq territory. Now, one of the questions I get all of the time, especially whenever there's any media around certain issues, is this question of, okay, what's the difference between Shubenacadie First Nation, Indian Brook, and Sebaganagadie? Are they three different First Nations?
Shubenacadie is a town that I live in, just adjacent to the reserve, but it's on the traditional territory of the Mi'kmaq people, and it's on the Sebaganagadie River in the Sebaganagadie territory of the Mi'kmaq Nation, which is one of our traditional districts. So for me, Sebaganagadie is it's home to me. It's the territory, the district, it makes up our world. If you're from a traditional district, you come from that, you grow from that. And that's who you are in your life. That's who you are and who you become. So Indian Brook is the name they gave to the little area where they centralized our people to, away from the Sebaganagadie River in the Sebaganagadie territory. They moved us on up to 8 kilometers inland to marshland, where there was no roads, nothing we could do there, no way to survive. but it was meant as a policy of not colonization, but genocide. So Indian Brook is the what they refer to as the reservation where they colonized us too. And just right there, you get a really huge story with that one question. Now, the funny thing is about that Indian Brook and this, when they moved us up there in this centralization, that was prophesied to happen before it happened. When the Mi'kmaq were living in Sebaganady along the river and within the villages and territories, we had some families that lived towards that area, but not in these marshlands or anything. And there was seven women coming together in the early 1930s doing ceremony. And I'm going to share this with you. I'm going to share this prophecy with you because I wasn't expecting to share this with you. But I think it's really important to the context that we're talking about today. So in my community, we had an elder named by the name of Bella Maloney. And she was the elder there. They call her Big Mom. The youngest there was Isabel Knockwood-Shea. We all know Dr. Isabel and her sister, Rose Morris. They were 7 and 8 or something like that at the time. And they were the youngest of the women there during the ceremony. And it was a full moon ceremony by an old pine tree that everybody knows, the old pine tree. And during that time, the white owl appeared to Bella Maloney, and everybody was just waiting, and she went, and she could understand and communicate with the owl. And at first I thought, how do they do that? How do they talk that? But as I become an elder and in touch with my own spirituality, you know how it happens. You understand how these teachings come, and you trust them. Every major event in Mi'kmaq governance and war moves and everything throughout history has been recorded as having dreams, visions, messages that guided our leaders, our heads of states, our people, whether a war was coming or what a disease or medicines we need. So we can't no longer deny that they are a big, big part of Indigenous worldview, spirituality, and language. So they're so connected. The worldview is our consciousness, our spirituality, with the connection we have with the earth. And these all make up who we are as humanity. And we fell apart from that. But after this prophecy, you know, I became familiar again with it after knowing about it for many years. And it talks about how our community was going to undergo a lot of changes. We weren't a community. We were just a couple of wigwams and huts or whatever. But she prophesied that there would be wide roads coming to this land, and they were going to bring in a disease of the mind, body, and spirit over our people, and that one of the things that we were going to have to face is that we were going to have to learn another language. When I got that message, I thought we were losing our language because of the residential schools, because of the reservation systems, because of centralization of the two reserves in Nova Scotia and Mi'kmaq. One was to be Sebaganaggety, Indian Brook, my community. We were prophesied that we had to learn a new language, which means they had to strip our language from us. And our children, our people, our community, we bared that. We bared the loss so that we could learn anew. I met with the Grand Council April 22nd. I petitioned my great leaders on behalf of the women, the dreamers, the visionaries, the ones that carried those ancient sacred knowledge. I petitioned my Grand Council and my Grand Chief. I said, we need to step out into the world stage, and we need to be a part of this global solution. We are the most important trading partner with every country right now that we're watching. And so it didn't really hit home. You know, I'm just coming to this point in my life that, okay, we had to suffer this so we could be armed and dangerous. And this morning I had the honor, absolute honor, to be with our grand chief. And we had a call with the doctors, Canadian Association of Physicians on the Environment, Kate. And he started speaking in Mi'kmaq. He struggled to turn it into what he was trying to say and feel to the doctors. He couldn't do it. The elder women in Eskasoni, their prophecies that went to them wasn't that they had to lose, they had to learn another language. The prophecies given to the elders and the women in Cape Breton and Unimagi communities, we had one elder that went to the Grand Council and she said, can I learn the men's chants? Can I learn the men's chants? I am a woman. They belong to the ancient ones. And they agreed. They allowed her to carry the ancient chants of the Mi'kmaq men. And that was Sarah Denny. And she taught her children and her grandchildren and the community. And then the next community, even my community now knows those chants. We know those chants. Our grandkids are dancing here to those chants. So our two communities in Mi'kma'ki prophesized to play two very, very, very different roles. But it wasn't until today that, you know, having the conversation with Grand Chief that I realized this. It came to me and him this morning as we're talking about important state business. And we realized that, you know, it's time now to come together. And the ancient language, the rules, the law, the governance, that has to be married back. And we have to share our ways.
I never heard it expressed that way, about how we were forced to learn another language or two. Sometimes it's French and English or one or the other. And I never heard it expressed that we have turned that around and used it as a tool to defend ourselves, to assert our rights, to do those things. And to me, that's a very important way of looking at it. And then the other part really is what you brought up about, you know, but we still have to make sure that our language is protected and that, you know, we're learning our language. For example, Indian residential schools or day schools or Indian hospitals or 60 Scoop and all the ways in which the government has taken us away from our families or communities, our culture and language and the way we see the world. So someone like me, for example, I'm not fluent. And so I've tried different ways to keep trying to learn the language as I go along. And I wanted to know from your perspective, let's just say there are Mi'kmaq people who are listening to this show and think, you know, I want to learn the language. What are some of the ways in which you yourself have made a commitment to learning the language and how do you do it?
I just taught a course and we invited the elders in for a feast and some sharing. The students wanted to learn the Lord's Prayer. And the reason they wanted to learn the Lord's Prayer, the elder told a story at the wake of another elder and how they had saved the language in the residential school. For the two of them, our only two speakers in the community, how they saved the language so that they maintained their language. And what they did is under the blankets, they would say the Lord's Prayer to each other or together. So my students wanted to come in and they all agreed between the elder and the students that we would give them a half an hour a week and they learned the Mi'kmaq Lord's Prayer. And so we had 22 students in the community that are now able to go and say the Lord's Prayer. And they did it because they knew that that's how our elders, as children, learn to preserve the language. And if they could do it to survive our beautiful baby children, then why couldn't we as young university students? And they did. And I think that group of students, the whole time, it felt like we were in ceremony with them. I'm like, I feel like I'm in ceremony. And that this is going to happen whether I'm here or not. It's unfolding. And I really believe that the times of the prophecies, the visionaries, the ones that predicted all these things that we see happening in the world, we have to trust that they're going to bring that language back to us in a way that it may not be. I may not be a fluent Mi'kmaq speaker. I may never have the right context of it can change so much. I may never get it all back or any of it, but I'm happy to understand it, and I'm happy to learn about it. I'm happy to promote it. I'm happy to teach my children and grandchildren what I know. So we may not get it all, but it is happening, and people are coming into places, positions of power. The elder, Sarah Denny, who went and asked to hold on to those chants and is bringing them back, that is what's bringing the language back to our people and our children and our families and our communities. And every time you hear those ancient Mi'kmaq songs being played, our language is being transferred back to us. Our spirits are waking up to the knowledge, the sound, the words, the feelings, the understanding. Even if we don't know the words, our spirits, our hearts do, and we are going to see the Mi'kmaq people become really, really strong. And we're coming together. And, you know, we're all here now to this point where we're just resettling. When we find the language, we're going to find our governance. When we find our language, we're going to find our health. We're going to find all these things together. Our children will be protected. These are all happening. They're all happening in our world. And I never thought that I would be on earth to see them. You hear the prophecies and you think they're still 100 or 200 years down the road, but they're here and they're now.
Cheryl, honestly, I feel like I have learned so much from you just in a few minutes. Like, I never thought about language in the sense of it being our health as well. Like, I've thought about language as, okay, there's worldview, there's cultural values. You can see some of our laws, place names tell you where our territory is. But I never took it that step further to say, oh, well, it's also about our health. It's about our physical health, our mental health, like everything about our spirituality. I never really thought about language itself as ceremony. So to hear you talk about that made me think about my own experiences. Like, what were the first Mi'kmaq words I learned? They were the ones from our songs. I didn't know what they meant, but I just knew that they were Mi'kmaq words and they were in their songs, and how that made me feel. And so instead of having a doom and gloom kind of outlook about our language, you're really presenting this positive outlook that we're in this time. We are revitalizing our language and everything else around it, the governance that's part of it, and that our young kids, instead of, you know, some people write off our young kids like, oh, they're playing video games and that, you know, they're not going to pass on the language. And you're showing that, hey, there's university students who care about this. We're passing it on to our younger kids, and that in fact all these young, even very, very young kids have the power and ability to learn a multitude of languages. They could learn Wolastoqiyik and Haudenosaunee and Mi'kmaq, like we did in the old times, like pre-contact. And so we have a future of our language. And so to really think about, okay, all of the ways in which we're going to do that. And I wanted to ask you, because I've heard Mi'kmaq youth say that they use this app on their phone for Mi'kmaq language, or they go online and use the Mi'kmaq language dictionary, or they go on YouTube and just listen to people talking Mi'kmaq. What do you think about that as a one of the ways in which they could be learning Mi'kmaq in addition to, say, being in ceremony or going to powwows or talking to elders?
When I was doing the course with my students, they all were excited. And I just come back next week, and they brought in two or three different apps. They brought in ways of reading and writing the prayer phonetically in the Mi'kmaq language. A few weeks later, one of the students, the only one that said, I've been raised Christian. I don't know what to believe about the Mi'kmaq spiritual way. She came to class and she said, I was cleaning in my house and I come up with this old piece of birch bark in a frame and Mi'kmaq hieroglyphics in the Lord's Prayer. And it was old and it was ancient. It was her grandparents or something. And it was just this really beautiful piece of history culture that came to her when she needed it. So the language is going to come back in people's personal ways. And for this class, the 22 of them brought it together and they did it together and they were brave and they got up together and they would have never did it on their own. They all said, I always wanted to learn. Everyone says that, but nobody did. And then for them, it just naturally evolved. I was just standing back. I did nothing. I was like, wow, you guys are great. But I'm seeing that in other ways too. I'm seeing our people starting to self-govern themselves. I've seen it with my students learning the language. I also seen it with the fishermen that are, being chased by Department of Fisheries and Oceans and drones following them around on our river systems and police arresting them and, taking their shoes and socks and coats and letting them walk in their phones in the dark. And so these people here, I'm in the group and I seen them, they started self-governing, self-regulating, determining in which rivers they were going to go, whether they were going to split up or how many people were there and where the species were, and all these things they were doing on their own. And I knew then that, to me, that was a sign that the prophecies are coming together. Like, there's certain things that we wait for. So when you have 22 students from Sebaganagani and the Iroquois Mohawk prophecies, I heard this in the 90s, they said, those who lost the most will be the ones that lead the healing. So I just listened to the video of my students and our community of Sebaganagani with Centralization Road. The white owl prophesies that. And I have a picture taken the other day of an owl on that very road that crossed the flats in the Indian Brook, and that's Centralization Road. And it was early in the morning and the mist and everything, and one of our fishermen stopped. There was an owl standing on the road, didn't move. He got out, he looked at him, he talked to him, he took a picture. And they captured that moment. And then the owl decided eventually to leave. But that picture to me was a sign to me that the prophecies, the white owl, the women, the time of prophecies is now.
We found 1,000 ways to make sure that not only were we staying Mi'kmaq people, but we were infusing our culture and language and laws and everything around us for this very time. That's why I wanted you on here, because you bring a different perspective to all of the issues that are all interrelated in terms of our language being a form of self-governance. And self-governance also includes these other things, which includes the right to trade, for example, or our treaty rights. And
I appreciate how you bring that to the language conversation, because too often people misunderstand Indigenous language as quote unquote just about singing and dancing or just about a culture, and not understanding that we're sovereign nations and that it's about nationhood. And I'm wondering, you know, just before we wrap up, if you have any thoughts around the importance of our language, the Mi'kmaq language, to our sovereignty, our independence, our nationhood, our lawmaking, like everything it means to be us.
One of the things I've read over and over again is how old and ancient our language is and how it has to be one of the most evolved languages in the world. And I really believe that the hieroglyphics come from us. And I think we have a whole lot to share with the world. And I think the world's going to be coming to Mi'kma'ki. I think it's time to share and celebrate, recognize, respect, uphold, protect that treaty relationship that anyone in Mi'kma'ki has, the joy of being in our territory. They are our Mi'kmaq partner. They are our treaty partners. Both sides of the treaty relationship have to be a part of that solution.
Do you see why I follow Cheryl Maloney's work so closely? I appreciate how she helped us understand that Mi'kmaq laws, values, and ideologies are embedded right in our language. I learned a lot, and not just that, she left me feeling inspired and hopeful. There's some days when I feel so discouraged, like maybe the Mi'kmaq language will just die out. But then I talk to people like Cheryl, who reminds me that our younger generation has things well in hand. She also helped remind me that learning the Mi'kmaq language is a form of resistance and decolonization, and that our language is the heart of our sovereignty and nationhood. Well, I better get to it. I have a lot more work to do if I want to be fluent in the Mi'kmaq language and pass it on to my grandkids. Hulalio'ok, thank you. Thank you to all of you for taking the time to learn about and support Indigenous languages. I'm Pam Palmiter for Words and Culture.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Maltus.
Ninuis Ahaha Miku Kwakwal.
Kachu Nautano.
Wapamatin Mina.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thank you for your constant support. You help keep independent community radio alive.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Melting ice is not the only reason global sea levels are rising. Climate change is also causing the ocean's water to expand, pushing it farther onto shore. As the climate warms, most of the additional heat in the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean. Today, the surface of the ocean is about a degree and a half Fahrenheit warmer than it was in the 1800s. When water gets hotter, water molecules start to move farther and farther away from each other. This causes the water to take up more space, a phenomenon called thermal expansion. This expansion is too small to notice in a cup or a bathtub, but across thousands of miles of ocean, it has a big impact. Over the past 30 years, global sea levels have risen by more than 3 inches, and scientists estimate that thermal expansion is likely responsible for about a third to a half of that increase. Sea level rise is already making floods more common in many coastal cities, like Rockport, Texas, and Norfolk, Virginia. And as people add more planet-warming carbon pollution to the atmosphere, the ocean is warming and expanding, and glaciers are melting even faster. Together, these changes are causing sea levels to rise more rapidly and pushing the ocean farther onto shore.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.